This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Taylor Randall, Dean at the University of Utah David Eccles School of Business. Taylor became the dean in July of 2009. That was just 6 years ago, and yet so much has changed since then. The business school now has a beautiful state-of-the-art building, and they are moving up in the ratings of the best business schools in the nation. Join us to hear more about the management, the business, and the entrepreneurship programs available today at the University of Utah. And if we're lucky, we just might get a sneak peek into what the future looks like for the U. Taylor, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Doug, I appreciate you having me today. It's a pleasure to be here and be able to talk a little bit about my passion, the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah.
Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. I was just on campus a couple weeks ago. I was asked to come speak to some business students, and I was really struck and impressed by the energy in the student body and just everything that's going on there. Beautiful new building, lots of new construction going on also. Tell our audience, what's all the excitement about?
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, it's pretty easy to get an audience like you addressed, an audience full of students excited about things. And I think that's what motivates all of us to be there. There are a couple big things going on, especially at the University of Utah in general and the business school in particular. We've taken a really clear tact that we want to be part of the economic ecosystem of this state. And being a part of that is training entrepreneurs and getting people excited about entrepreneurial companies. And so what you find is we're increasingly attracting students that care about ideas, that care about changing the world. Sometimes it's in a very commercial sense, and other times it's in a very, very social sense. And if you look over the last few years of what we've been able to do, you see entrepreneurs at both of those levels. Social entrepreneurs that are trying to change the way society operates, but also entrepreneurs in perhaps a more traditional sense that are trying to create wealth around new products and services.
So you've talked a lot about entrepreneurship. Is that one of the major focuses, one of the major pillars of the future, of the focus of the business school?
It certainly is, and you may have a question about this later on, but the big investment and a big bet that we're taking focuses around a new facility that's going up on campus. It's a facility called the Lasson Studios. This is about 120,000 square feet. It's a facility that we think is unique in the country right now. We spent about a year looking around the country at places where entrepreneurs build businesses. We went to New York. We went to Las Vegas. We went to the Bay Area, San Francisco especially. And what we came up with a designer out of Los Angeles, was a concept which we're calling the Lasson Studios. And think of it as we're taking 400 dorm rooms and smashing them together with incubator space in some very, very unique ways. And we recently launched a campaign to recruit the 400 best student entrepreneurs in the country. We're going to spend $3 million on scholarships to attract them there. And in addition to the scholarships, there's a whole set of infrastructure and financing that's going to be available to those students. We think what they're going to be able to do is come and start a company, and we don't want them dropping out of school. We actually want them on campus.
You want them dropping into school,
exactly.
Not dropping out, right?
That's a good – I may use that. Thank you, Doug.
Yeah, so that, you're right. I do have that in my notes for later, but let's talk about it now. So the Lasson Studios, Pierre Lasson, right, is the lead donor for that. Major initiative, and it's 120,000 square feet. It's going to be 400 students. Is it just business school students, or how is that designed?
Yeah, it's not. I'll tell you a little bit about the design. We are trying to bring students from across campus and additionally folks from the community to come be a part of this. In fact, I would say we will have failed if it's just business students. We've got programs going with the School of Engineering. We've got programs going with the School of Medicine. We've got programs going with our gaming program on campus.
Gaming program, by the way, is number one in the country. That's huge. Does that fall under the umbrella of the business school?
It doesn't. That is a joint venture between the School of Fine Arts and the engineering school. But we partner with them on several academic programs. And I'll tell you, they are an exciting group of people to work with.
That rating just came out, right? It's the first time you're rated number one, and that is huge. And that's the kind of thing that I think we're all looking at and saying, boy, this huge investment in infrastructure, in people, and we're seeing the results moving up in the rankings, and it's about more than that, but that's certainly an indication that you guys are heading in the right direction.
Yeah, we've always felt that, you know, rankings were kind of hopefully an after-the-fact indicator of what actually has been going on, and certainly the gaming program at the University of Utah has been doing great things for a long, long time. So,
but I've kind of sidetracked us. I want to stay on LaSalle while we're here because it's big. Let's keep talking about this. So it's not just business school students. It's interdepartment. Is that right? Computer science. Maybe is going to be any engineers in there as well, or what would be the ideal blend?
Yeah, I think what you'd see is an ideal blend is a set of students coming together around an idea that probably requires interdisciplinary talent. So let me give you, you know, a couple of ideas that we're kind of starting with. This facility has four floors on it. And the floors are divided into different sets of living spaces. So you have a traditional dorm room, but you also have a San Francisco-style loft. And you also have an area that is basically, think of it as walking into a warehouse, and then students have living cubes, 7 by 7 by 7 living pods that basically have a bed.
That's not much space.
It's not much space. But what they do is they can take those cubes and they can move them around and self-configure. So if you've got an idea.
They can roll their bedroom? Is their bedroom?
They roll their bedrooms
that
together.
That is great.
And then they can
work. Is anybody doing that?
You
said you visited these various locations. Is that an idea that you're borrowing from somebody, or is that first happening here?
To our knowledge, this may be a first. So it is.
Have you heard of a company called Steam?
I haven't. Tell me about Steam.
So they're a game. They're one of the younger people in the audience are cringing. I hadn't heard about Steam until a year ago. I mention it because very successful company, $1 billion+. And it's how a lot of young people play games online now. It's the leading – it's the app store for games if you're really into games. I mention them just because their employees, their desks, their workspace are portable as well.
Right.
And their employees are free to quit one team and join another team if it's more exciting. And you think about it as a business person having to allocate resources in the team.
Yeah.
Steam has said, you know what? Our engineers know what the most exciting projects are. Let's let them vote.
Yeah.
So if you're not a good leader of your team, you know, people start rolling their desk away from your team into somebody else's. It's a similar thing. That's going to be really interesting to see where the pods end up being.
Well, so I like your analogy. That's exactly, I think, what we're thinking will happen. So let's say you get an engineering student that has an idea for a piece of software or some type of device. What they'll do is they'll literally in this facility put up their shingle and say, Here's my idea. Here's my passion. What are they going to need? Well, they're going to need some human capital. And what we're hoping is that it's populated with enough business students and industrial designers that are there that they'll put up that shingle and those folks will roll their cubes together for 5 or 6 weeks and see how it takes off. If they are able to develop the idea to the point where they get a prototype, let's say it's a device, we're very grateful to Zions Bank, who's providing a set of seed capital and seed grants to all of these students, so they can sit down immediately and get who knows $5,000 to develop a prototype. In the main floor of this building, you're going to have things like 3D printing, basic kind of manufacturing and shop, so you can go down and kind of craft that prototype there immediately. They'll be able to hit the prototyping labs around the rest of campus, and within 6 or 7 weeks say, hey, it's going to work, or if it's not, they'll roll their cube somewhere else and try something
amazing. I mean, as you talk about it, this is what I think everybody wants their educational experience to be. Is this happening anywhere else in the nation, or are you guys really forging new ground right here?
So currently we think this is a one-of-its-kind facility. We did look around. There's certainly some facilities like this in the private sector that exist. And there is a small kind of 30-person dorm in Canada that does some of this, but at its scale, I think this will, for the time being, will be one of a kind.
So I love this, and I think that just being that the building's going to be right next to the business building, and I think that's some of the energy and excitement that the kids that I visited with had. They see this future, and they're excited about it. Tell us, how did this get started? Was it? I know Pierre Lassonde is a big supporter of
sure.
it. Was it his vision day one, or was there a group of you that came together and over years came up with this big vision?
You know, if you go back to the beginning, three individuals, Jack Britton, Troy D'Ambrosio, and Pierre Lassonde, came together, and Pierre's view was he'd like to make an investment in the University of Utah, but he wasn't quite sure what that would be. And those three individuals sat down, and they crafted the idea for the Lassonde Entrepreneur Center. And they began small. They began by just commercializing technologies that were coming out of the University of Utah. And then the next thing you knew, it grew into some student programs. And after about 5 years, Pierre came back and said, you know, I'm ready to make my next big investment, but it has to be unique. At that point, I came in to the picture as well. And along with Jack and Troy and their vision, we started brainstorming. And quite honestly, we pitched several ideas to Pierre, and he said, ah, that's not it. And we finally settled on this notion of a living learning space. And I think it was a combination of observing the way that that students want to consume education in a more experiential way. They want to have meaning attached to classes. Which is one of the things we haven't talked about that I hope is going to happen with this facility. They want meaning attached to classes, and they're thinking of their careers in very, very different ways. And then also you look, and I think this came out of inspiration we saw as we observed the way people live and work in New York City and in big urban areas, right? They don't necessarily need a cubicle, right? They've got their laptop. They sit at a coffee bar. And they come up with ideas, and they run their companies.
Even
and,
desk.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Desk,
right.
I was at a facility the other day, and the desks were tiny.
Right.
And I was asking, how do they get any work done? And the reality is the desk is just wide enough now for a laptop, because that is our work environment now,
yeah.
is our computers.
Well, and I don't know what you've observed there. I'd be curious as to your views, Doug, on this, but it's different than I think the way perhaps I'm going to infer that you were trained somewhat the same way I was, but it's different, right? And it's exciting. It's fun to see.
It keeps us young.
It does.
Keeps us young being involved in this. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Taylor Randall, Dean at the University of Utah David Eccles School of Business. So we've got this beautiful new facility. Pierre Lassonde is the lead donor, raising, but it takes a community, right? Pierre, I'm assuming. Seeded the effort, primed the pump, and you got the community behind it. You mentioned Zions Bank as one of the supporters. It's a lot of work to raise the money to make a building like this, to make a vision like this a reality. It's a lot of work on your part. It's a lot of work on your team's part and a community leader. So first, thanks. I mean, this is really exciting what you guys are doing. And the state of Utah is very fortunate to have generous folks like Pierre Lassonde and hard workers. You mentioned Jack Britton, yourself, Troy D'Ambrosio. Takes a lot of work, so thank you for doing that. As you think about new programs outside of the Lassonde Studio and what's happening in the core, you know, the business school itself, so this is going to be for 400 students at the Lassonde Center. In addition, there's going to be the traditional MBA program going mm-hmm. on. As you think about the vision for that core program, mm-hmm. what are a couple of things that are top of mind for you there?
Sure. First off, the Lassonde Studios, while there'll be 400 students living there, we think it'll have a capacity to be able to deal with about 5,000 students
wow.
at a given time. And so we're hoping that that entrepreneurial, innovative spirit touches all of our students. We don't think, right, that every student will want to be an entrepreneur. But our vision is that in this community that's full of vibrant startup companies that are growing fast, we want to be able to provide the human capital that feeds that ecosystem. So to that end, we think about all of our programs somewhat in a similar light. And there are a set of, I think, themes that tie our programs together. First and foremost, we try to attract the best and brightest students to the University of Utah, and you're seeing that, I think, from top to bottom in all of our programs. Our programs have grown in terms of students on average 7% for the past 5 years. That is actually those that are enrolling. So applications have actually gone up higher. So we're experiencing tremendous growth, and we actually think that's, you know, an indication that the market is accepting of the type of education we're providing. The second big theme is that we want students to have an experience. And we're not thinking about it as, gee, I'm coming and I'm coming to class, but we want you to have an experience that's going to be uniquely catered to you. And so we're setting up things like Lassonde, and I could talk about two or three other centers that we've developed that are very similar. So we have a center called the Sorensen Center for Global Impact Investing, and you're a finance guy, and you understand.
I was going to say this sounds like my area.
Yeah,
now.
This is your area. So as we know right now and currently, there are a lot of people that manage capital that are also concerned about changing the world, and they care about a double bottom line, right? What is the social impact that my investment is having, as well as the financial return that I am receiving? And Jim Sorensen generously came to us and endowed a center with that basic idea in mind. And it has a set of activities. One of those activities is to identify, not necessarily train, but identify promising young social entrepreneurs around the globe and to try to provide them funding. So
not just University of Utah alums, not just folks
right.
in Utah, but around the world.
Right. We partner with a company called Village, or a venture firm called Village Capital, and they run cohorts of entrepreneurs in places like Brazil, Louisville, Kentucky, Kenya, Africa, India as well. And what happens in those cohorts is they'll find a set of entrepreneurs around a theme or a geography. They'll vet them over a period of 3 to 4 months, and we embed our students in those cohorts as financial analysts.
As you were describing this, I was thinking, how do we tie that back to the state of Utah? So it's really giving opportunities for mm-hmm. students that would be very difficult for them to find without
right.
being involved in a program like this.
Right. Those cohorts, by the way, Village Capital runs cohorts here in the state of Utah as well around different themes. They ran a medical technology cohort here a short time ago, and a fintech cohort here a short time ago.
As I hear you talking about this, I think Utah is actually uniquely situated. I think our citizens are much more comfortable thinking about living internationally, in part because many of them have gone on missions
yeah.
around the world. So the thought of going to Brazil to work for a startup or a social impact company for a period of time, I grew up in Ohio. I think a lot
yeah.
of my classmates in Ohio would have thought, well, wow, that's yeah. a big step. For here, it's just, you know, all their buddies, you know, many of their friends have
yeah.
done something similar. So
yeah.
I think Utah is uniquely qualified for that. That is neat. You were saying there were a couple programs. What are one or two other ones?
The other program that's located in that center is what we call the Policy Innovation Lab. And the Policy Innovation Lab helps facilitate kind of a new type of financial instrument called a social impact bond. And it turns out the state of Utah is one of the leaders in that area. And a social impact bond is constructed around a social idea, and I'll describe one. There's one in early childhood education here that's been facilitated by the state of Utah, Mayor McAdams and the county and the United Way. And what they do is they identify a social need, in this case, the notion that if we were to make a big investment in early childhood education, that we would be able to, the government would be able to avoid costs of services later on. And so what the government says is, hey, if you, private investor, in this case it was Goldman Sachs and the Pritzker Foundation, if you're willing to put some money into this program up front, we, in a bond-type structure, will give you a return on that investment as we save in terms of services provided to these folks later on. And so the Policy Innovation Lab is actually right now working with five different municipalities around the western United States to facilitate those. We recently received a grant from the White House Social Innovation Fund for just over $1 million, and that's helping facilitate those things.
All the stuff I wasn't aware of that's going on there. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Taylor Randall, Dean at the University of Utah David Eccles School of Business. I mentioned there's all this stuff going on that I didn't know was going on, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you come on. I was on campus, and I'm like, wow, there's just so much going on. And one of the things is Kelly Collins at the business school was kind of describing to me what's all going on. I was like, how are you guys coordinating all this? And she actually hooked me up with Troy D'Ambrosio, who kind of talked to me about how we're coordinating all these different efforts. Share with our audience, from a leadership standpoint, how do you coordinate all these various things that are going on?
Yeah. You know, when our approach thus far, we're hoping it will continue to work, is to try to encourage innovative opportunities on campus. And when you're doing that, you have to be able to live with a degree of chaos. And so what we've tried to do is provide some light coordination. And what we do is we have a council of individuals that comes together probably every month to 6 weeks, and they coordinate the best they can. And they actually do quite a bit of nice coordination. So,
for example, you do mention you have to be comfortable with chaos, and that is the reality. There's a lot of experimentation, and just like for entrepreneurship, a lot of the ideas don't work. You give it your best shot, and I like to study different presidents of the United States, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt is considered one of the great leaders that we've had in the country. What a lot of people don't know is the New Deal was a big success, and there are lots of things that worked. What people forget about, and history doesn't remind us of enough, is probably 2/3 of the programs that he tried did not work. And you have to experiment, and you have to try things, and you have to be okay that, you know what, you're going to invest time and effort into something, and it may not work out.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's one of the things I've learned, certainly on campus in this role, is you've got to embrace experimentation, and you've got to hope that the individuals who are looking at ideas that may not work are willing to stay with you and take a swing at a second idea.
So tell us about a program you started in 2009, mm-hmm. 6 years. There's a lot of programs that have worked, and you look at it and say, wow, we're really glad we did this. Tell us about a program that maybe you thought had a lot of potential, but for whatever reason didn't pan out.
You know, I think some of the interesting things that haven't worked, we've tried to have some partnerships with companies in terms of spinning technologies into the university, and I'm still not unconvinced that can't work.
So technology that was not developed at
the university,
let's assign some of the IP to the U and work with the University of Utah. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. And mainly you'll get a set of companies that want the energy of students, right? So a lot of these ideas might be social media types of ideas, right, where you've got really a natural student base there that's going to embrace it quickly. And if you could get those students involved in those ideas, then you might have something and make some immediate market. Again, I'm still not convinced that these ideas can't work, but we haven't been able to figure that out.
And some of them have. I'll tell you about one that my firm's an investor in, Catheter Connections.
Yeah.
Vicky
There's
Farrar.
One. Sure.
You know, it developed outside of the U. They wanted the resources and the help of the University of Utah, and they figured out a way through the Technology Commercialization Office to bring that into the envelope. And now they're just growing by leaps and bounds. Vicky's a hardworking woman and is a great leader for it, and it takes a lot of tenacity. But the university, she would tell you, we've had her on the show, the company would not be where it's at today and may not have been successful if it weren't for the University of Utah.
So it has been fun to see Catheter Connections. I wasn't aware that you were an investor in that, and they are going gangbusters.
They are.
It's been a good educational experience for our students as well. We've had folks from the law school engaged in that. You've got students from business and engineering all have been engaged in that company.
Right. So let's talk about this private-public partnership, because I'm really interested in that. And I think there's a lot of times there's these great initiatives that you got to prime the pump, and it's going to take public support to get it going, and then it can take over and be a standalone entity and support itself. And I know you're an advisor to the University Venture Fund, and I think I would use that as an example of one that went that way. Tell our audience what the University Venture Fund is and how it's helping the students and how it's standing on its own as well.
Sure. So the University Venture Fund is one of the largest, I would say, student-run venture funds in the country. About 18 point, just over $18 million of capital.
It was the first, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there were others before, but certainly in its structure, it was unique in that most university venture funds that are run by students are donated capital, and this actually had some limited partners and operates just like a venture capital fund. The way that was originally set up is it was just set up as a set of projects. There was a seed donation from a donor that said, you know, I'd like to educate the venture capital community of the future. Why don't we give you some money and why don't you start doing projects, value-added projects for venture firms? And as that went along, we realized that students could create and do value-added projects for firms. So, for example, you've done a lot of due diligence in your day, Doug, but, you know, oh, I've got 1,000 customer calls that need to be made. Well, if you've got a good script and you hand that to students, right, they can do that for you, and it's a great educational experience.
It's a really interesting model because their pitch to firms like ours is, let us help you do the due diligence.
Yep.
And what we ask in return is a chance to co-invest, to put a little bit of money at work behind it. You know, frankly, for any investment firm, it's the research, the due diligence. You want to make sure you're making a good decision, so you can never do too much due diligence. So it's a great partnership, and it works both ways. Peter, I'm spacing on his last name. You can help me out. Peter that runs the program.
Gave me a call. Tom Stringham right now runs the program.
Okay, and there's another gentleman there. Anyways, you know, we've worked together on several deals, and he gave me a call the other day. They had an opportunity to invest in Lyft.
Yeah,
which is really, I mean, Uber and Lyft, right? I mean,
right.
You don't get those calls every day now. And in my case, because of what I do on the public market, we couldn't invest because if it goes public, we might want to invest on the public side. But on my own, I didn't have access to the Lyft deal. And here the University Venture Fund was able to bring that to the table this way. So it's a great public-private partnership, and I really like those. You're also on the advisory board for Epic Ventures, which is a standalone private firm. Why did you decide to do that?
You know, from my vantage point, it's fun to be engaged with the business community in general. And so being able to be on those boards allows me to kind of get a front row seat to what's actually going on. I think it helps the education at the University of Utah because we can see trends before they start. And certainly Epic is a wonderful firm, and they've been very, very kind in terms of, you know, allowing me to take a peek into what's going on.
Well, and you've been kind to help them out as well. They want to have advisors on board there. So how long have you been on their advisory board?
Oh, it's just been several years.
Okay, good. And what do you think you've learned from that experience?
You know, I think what I learn is I look at any companies, and you know this as well as anybody, Doug, is you've got to get a feel for an entrepreneur. And how they operate and how they tick, and you've got to be able to develop judgment around that person because you're not going to have all information, right? It's not about sitting down and looking at the reports that are given out. You got to have a feel for people, and I think those are some of the things that I gain.
I love
as
that
an advisor,
answer, and that comes from experience. You know, in real estate, it's about location, location, location. In venture, it's about the entrepreneur, the entrepreneur, the entrepreneur. You know, a lot of these companies have to pivot their ideas. You can do that, but you can't pivot your entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
It's certainly not easy to do.
Well, and as you know, if you don't mind me asking you a question, Doug, it's a hard thing. Take a look at a student. What do you tell them, right? If you don't understand what a good entrepreneur is, what do you tell them they need to do to develop to become a good entrepreneur? I'd be curious to see what you would tell students. What educational experiences should they have?
So that's a really good question, and I don't often have the tables turned on this show, so thanks for doing that. You know, I think so much of it, like in life, is experiential, unfortunately. And I think there's a lot to be said for getting a formal education and blending that with working with the best.
Yeah.
Go work for a Qualtrics. Go work for David Elkington at InsideSales.com. Go work for Aaron Sconard up at Pluralsight. See what it's like to be in a really high-growth environment. See how the best in class do things. But don't wait too long to start your own venture because the challenge is it's such a big job that none of us are ready for it. And if you wait until you're ready for it, you'll be my age and it'll be too late, right? The window will have passed. And I get a lot of joy out of coaching and mentoring entrepreneurs. But if you wait till you have the life experiences that you and I have now, there'll be other things going on in your life that'll be very difficult to do it. So you do have to take a leap of faith.
Yeah.
And it's one of the core values that I've got teenage girls that I talk to them about is just the importance of faith. Not necessarily faith in a higher power, but faith that if you do the right things, life is going to work out, and to give yourself freedom to pursue your dream. It may play out very differently than you thought it was going to, but it's going to work out. It may not, the venture itself may not be successful, but it's going to directionally head you in the right place. And it's a lot easier to deal with things. Boy, I wish I'd had this experience. If I'd had this before, I would have avoided this mistake. It's a lot easier to deal with that than it is to deal with regret. And guard yourself against putting yourself in a situation where you might have regret. Have faith. Take that leap. So that's my answer. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Taylor Randall, Dean of the Business School at the University of Utah. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Taylor Randall, the Dean of the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. So you were talking earlier about getting the best of the best, and we were talking about a campaign that you've got going on for the LaSalle 400 and the $3 million worth of scholarships. And there's scholarships available for the business schools and the various programs that you're in. As you think about how do we get the best of the best, and Utah's very blessed. We have some very, very bright, very motivated, very entrepreneurial people here in the state. The programs at the U also are attractive to people outside of the state of Utah. And I should share with the audience, my wife and you worked together for several years at the U. She loved her experience there. And shortly after she started working with you, she told me you were heading out to China, Beijing. And I was like, China? You know, University of Utah? Why is the dean of the business school going to China? And I thought it was maybe to get, you know, corporate sponsors or something. But part of the trip was to introduce the University of Utah to some of their potential students that might want to come here and have access to these programs, and also opportunities for students to have jobs out there. But as you think about how do we get the best of the best students into the University of Utah, what are some things that are top of mind?
Yeah, sure. You know, what I think is great about this state, especially in the environment where you've got young people that want to be entrepreneurs, is it's just a really easy sell, right? You walk out and you say, do you want to be an entrepreneur? And they say, yes. And you say, well, let's pick five areas of the country where you might actually want to come and start your business. And it's a pretty easy story to say that Utah should be one of those. You know, it's got great business. It's got a great environment in terms of regulation for business. There are plenty of people that are willing to take risk for you. You've got a young population. You know, the list goes on and on and on. And then the other thing that I think I realized as I was getting my education is if you can bring folks with just varied backgrounds, and that may be because they lived in different places, or they're from different countries, or coming from different cultures, you put them together in rooms, and the melding of those ideas creates just some magic. And I think part of what we're trying to do is attract enough of those folks from outside of the state of Utah, and I think what it will do is add to our entrepreneurial culture that's already here. And what it will bring is a set of student-started businesses, right, that are already going to be seeing global markets rather than perhaps local markets. And I think that's what we want for this state, right, is a set of companies that participate globally. And you mentioned, you know, a couple, right, Qualtrics, Inside Sales. Those are folks that they think globally.
It's happening here in Utah, and it is so exciting. I mean, we have a half a dozen billion-dollar-plus companies. It's really, really hard to build those. I just saw a report the other day that per capita, Utah has more billion-dollar companies that have been created in the last 5 years than anywhere else. And there's a lot of places that we have to thank, right? You mentioned that our legislature is fairly forward-looking. I moved here from California. California kind of succeeds despite itself. I love California.
Yeah.
But when I was running my business, boy, they make it really hard. And I think the state of Utah makes it easy. When you want to get involved in the University of Utah, you make a couple phone calls and it's very easy to get involved. If we interviewed Parker Conrad, who's the CEO of Zenefits, that was having a challenge here in the state of Utah. His Zenefits was kind of outlawed. It was the way the old law was written. There was question whether or not they were complying with the law. And I asked Parker, how did you get the lobbying effort going in Utah? And, you know, the surprising answer was he didn't have to. There was a legislature individual who, unfortunately, I don't remember his name right now, but kudos to him. He looked at it and said, this isn't right. And he called Zenefits and said, hey, we're going to start doing this. I just want to let you know. That is really cool. And I don't think there's many states outside of Utah where you'd see that.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you. It's been my observation as well.
And part of that is just our culture of wanting businesses to thrive. You have a culture at University of Utah. We talked about how long it takes to build buildings, to start new programs. That all has a long lead time. Culture is something very similar, right? It takes a long, long time. You inherited a culture when you came into the business school to be the dean. And that's a long heritage. And I want to talk about heritage because you have an interesting heritage at the U, but we'll save that for a little bit later. But when you think about culture, not only did you inherit a culture, but it's different than a business in many ways because you have different cultures. You have the culture of the students, and then you have the culture of the faculty, and then you have the culture of how does the community interact. Let's start with the students. How would you describe the culture of the student body today and maybe where it was 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting question. I don't know that I've reflected on it all that much, and let me tell you why. I feel like because you have a new inflow of students, right, every year, they're literally pushing you and pushing our culture. You come in, you've got somebody that has new energy, somebody that's looking to get a job, someone that's looking to build their resume, someone that's looking to change something, and it just naturally, right, creates energy at a place. And I would say what we're seeing increasingly are students that want to take charge of their future. And maybe it's because of the entrepreneurial culture that's here in the state, but they want to create value in terms of enterprises.
As opposed to just being passive consumers of the education, they want to be active in it.
They do. And in fact, just last week I was, sitting with a group of students who had been organizing clubs, and most of the clubs and activities, and it varied from accounting to marketing, had doubled in size over the past year. They want to be engaged.
All this focus on entrepreneurialism. When my wife first joined your team, in the class then was Matt Barron and Scott Rafferty.
Yep.
And the Entrepreneurship Club at the University of Utah had kind of been on again, off again. It was there.
Yeah.
And they really made it one of their main focuses. We're going to get this Entrepreneurship Club going, and we're going to make it sustainable so that it lasts. I mean, one of the challenges with culture, especially MBA student, is they have a half-life of 1 year. They're only there 2 years, so they have to do a lot of work to make things sustainable. So this spirit of being involved, of making things happen, of being active in their education is one of the things you're seeing in the student body. How about on the other end of it? Because it is kind of this unnatural blending. You have, on the other side of the equation, you have faculty members, many of whom are now tenured.
Yeah.
And are looking at really the long game, things that they want. They're doing research that's never been done anywhere in the world before. And you know what? It's not going to happen in 6 months. It's not going to happen in 12 months. It may take 3, 4, 5 years. So they're looking at the long game.
Yeah.
How would you describe the culture on the faculty side?
You know, what's been fun to see along the faculty side is they're actually quite innovative in terms of the types of individuals they want to bring into the faculty. 2 years ago, we started a strategy and entrepreneurship department, just dedicated right to the study of kind of business strategy and entrepreneurship. And to my mind, one of the few in the country. And then you start looking at the individuals that they want to bring in. They're bringing in postdocs that have already started .coms and decided to go back for PhDs. And we've had several of those individuals. And that is fun, because what they end up doing is they don't see a difference between the classroom and business. And so the whole thing just blends together for them. And you look at what they're creating, and I don't know whether to call it a classroom experience or just an entrepreneurial experience, the whole thing just kind of blends together.
Which is cool. I mean, that's kind of the next evolution. We've been talking about that. So we're talking about PhDs. I mean, you're the dean of the business school. That's a job that, for the most part, you need to have your PhD. So you've got your PhD from Wharton School of Business. And you've published a number of papers, and that's kind of what PhDs do, right? I mean, you have an intense interest in an area. You become a world expert in it. And then you bring the area of research, the area of knowledge forward by your own contributions. I looked up, I think it's ResearchGate, where these things are published. Yeah, ResearchGate. You've published or co-authored 18 papers. And several of them are very esoteric and very deep, you know. An empirical examination into the decision to invest in the fulfillment capacities, a study of internet retailers, which is actually really cool towards the end there. You know, should an internet retailer like Amazon do their own fulfillment, I'm guessing, or should they contract it out?
Yeah. Well, you embarrass me actually by even reading the title on air, and you probably already.
I have one more I'm going to read on air. I'll just give you a heads up.
You've probably already hit on the key to actually publishing in academics. You got to have a title that nobody wants to listen to. In fact, my wife jokes with me. She says, "You know, I've never read anything that you've published academically, Taylor. I'm actually afraid I wouldn't stick with you if I did." I think if you look at faculty that publish, most of them are picking off ideas that are actually pretty applicable. I'll use my own experience.
Well, that example right there. If you're not the next Amazon, should you build a fulfillment center?
Right.
It takes a lot of time, effort, and money.
And that research was started right kind of at the dot-com boom. And right, the central question to many internet retailers was help me make this decision. Yeah. And so we basically started saying, all right, we will help you make that decision. We surveyed them. We took a look at the theory behind it. And
I think it's fascinating work. And I say it not to bring out an example of something that's very deep and narrow in scope, just exactly the opposite. Here's, you know, that's something that can be applied. The other example is the auto industry. We'll talk about that later. That is your most recent paper, as far as I can tell, that you've done. But my question really has to do with you decided to get your PhD because you had an intense interest in an area. I considered it. I went to Stanford, got my business school. Love strategy. You mentioned strategy. Mm-hmm. And that was an area that I was gifted in. And the professor pulled me aside and said, hey, you know, you've got a talent here. I want to talk to you about maybe pursuing your PhD in this. And I thought about it for a long time. First, it was a compliment, right? And I love strategy, but I thought, do I really love it enough that I want to dedicate the rest of my life to it? And I decided not to. I wanted to have a broader experience. But as a PhD, the decision to become a dean, really, I'm guessing it's kind of either or. You don't have time to really do the deep research. Here's a life decision, and I think we all learn from hearing how other people make life decisions. How did you make the decision, hey, I'm going to, at least for a period of time, give up the research side of things and focus really on leading this program that you feel can become best in class over time? How'd you make that decision?
You know, there are obviously a number of factors, but when it came right down to it, I think I was at a stage in my career where I wanted to see if I could actually manage. Practice what you preach, they say. And I also looked at the set of challenges that were facing education in general. And I said, you know what? I enjoy change. I enjoy building things. There are a confluence of factors that are kind of coming together right now that this would really be a fun opportunity, because I think education is kind of primed to make some changes. You had funding models that were being thrown upside down because of the financial crisis. You had technology that was hitting classrooms and is still hitting classrooms in some really, really unique ways. And then you had this new type of student that was coming in that wasn't necessarily interested in going to work for a Fortune 100 company. I said, wow, right?
It's a big challenge.
Think if you can put those things together. I don't know if it's a challenge, but what an opportunity. And so to me, that's what excited me about it.
Great. And somehow you were able to weave in, while being dean, you co-authored a research paper, really a study on the North American auto industry, Let me see if I've got the title. Deployment of Manufacturing Flexibility in Empirical Analysis of the North American Automotive Industry. That came out in 2012, so you were dean. How were you able to do it all? I mean, you're going to Beijing, you're recruiting corporations to recruit here, and on top of that, you're doing a deep dive into this industry.
So can I confess on air? Will I be sued?
Yes.
I'll just thank my co-authors for finishing that off, right? There was
It takes a
village, and I may have done a lot of the early work there, but for sure they were the ones that carried that one home.
That's neat. I would guess that it meant a lot to you to be able to co-author another paper while you're being the dean. It's what good researchers do, and you're a good researcher, and I'm sure at some level you miss publishing, do you?
Yeah, you do. And really, different deans take their jobs and structure them in different ways. I think research is something that I have had to give up, and as well as teaching. I mean, you spend a lot of time building an institution while you're a dean, and that's probably the number one set of activities that I have to do.
You build an institution. You also, in many ways, are running a company, and the company is called the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. You mentioned during the financial crisis that the funding became very challenging. My understanding, though I'm not 100% sure I'm correct, is that the business school is revenue neutral for taxpayers. That the cost of the programs is really funded from the tuition that's paid and the money that the business school raises. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is true. And part of this vision was set by then now our president, David Pershing. He was provost at the time, and he had a tough challenge, right? You've got funding that necessarily was being cut because the state, statewide, we were kind of dealing with that financial crisis. And he began to come up with creative ways to get the university through it. And one of those creative ways was to run at least the business school a little bit more like a business, to grow.
And is that normal nationwide that the business school would be revenue neutral to taxpayers? Are there many states that do that? I mean, kudos. I'm so proud of Utah because we do so much with a relatively tight budget. I think it's one of the reasons our entrepreneurs are successful is they're right. willing to be scrappy. Are there many universities that are revenue neutral to taxpayers?
There are a few, and actually there's some great institutions that do it. So University of Michigan Business School, for example, the Darden School at Virginia. So you've got a couple that do it, and they are great examples. UCLA, the Anderson School, recently did that. And certainly I've spoken with the deans at those institutions to try to understand the challenges. It isn't without its risks.
It's hard.
But it's fun as well.
You gain a certain confidence by being independent, and good for you guys for being able to do that. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Taylor Randall, Dean of the Business School at the University of Utah. Welcome back to The Bottom Line at KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Taylor Randall, the Dean of the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. So I started off the interview mentioning that I went to speak to a group of students. And I was really struck and impressed with their passion and excitement for their education and what was going on. And, when I was an undergrad, my professors used to tease my class that, education is one of the things that you want as little as possible for your money. And there was a little bit of truth to that. Engineering was a really hard undergrad, and we certainly didn't need more homework. But what I saw in your student body was just this hunger and this thirst for more, they wanted more experiences and more learning, which is great. And here we are a month away from finals, so it's about to start getting heavy. And I think a lot of that has to do with you recruiting people that are entrepreneurial in nature. What percent of the class ends up doing something entrepreneurial right after getting out of the business school? And then maybe 5 years later, what does that go to?
Yeah, that's a good question. If you look right out of school, my guess is the percentage that start their own businesses is relatively small. It would be below it would be 10%, if that. But what they do is you'll see them in these entrepreneurial companies in the state of Utah, right? So the half dozen billion-dollar companies that we've got are populated with students coming out of our programs. And that is exactly what they're looking for, because we tend to place most of our students in the state, and that is where the economy is. And then what I think you end up seeing is you'll see folks that will they'll get that experience. You know, they might be the head of a sales team at one of these companies, and you know in the back of their head the ideas are just churning. And they'll see some derivative and some spinoff or some idea that that entrepreneurial company decided not to pursue. And then all of a sudden, they jump. And so the percentage of folks that jump to a new company actually, you know, gets higher. I actually don't know what that percentage would be, but I would guess it's at least double, you know, what it was initially.
And I've seen that play out myself just in my own firm's portfolio. We're an investor in a company called DemoChimp. Garen Hess is the CEO. And he would tell you that, you know, two of his key employees, Matt, or the two guys that I mentioned earlier, Matt Barron and Scott Rafferty, and they're killing it. But it takes a lot of work to build a company like that. And Scott and Matt are playing a pivotal role, getting great experiences very early in their career. And we talked earlier about culture. You need to have students that are thinking about it the right way to say, you know what, I'm going to turn down that job in management consulting, and I'm going to go work for this company that may or may not succeed, but it's going to be a great experience, and I'm okay with the fact that if it doesn't work, that, you know, I'll have to start over again. It takes some courage to do that. Speaking of failure and being willing to put yourself in a situation where you may not succeed, you know, if you look at the traditional past for 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when I went to business school, you know, a lot of kids were going into investment banking and management consulting, and that's an area where 75% of the students succeed going into that. Entrepreneurship is, by its very nature, you know, if you're lucky, it's your odds are 50-50, right? And truthfully, the odds are probably closer to 25% of succeeding. How do you get students comfortable with the idea that maybe for the first time in their lives, they're going to be involved in something that doesn't succeed?
Yeah. Well, that's maybe one of the hardest questions that's been asked me lately. I'll tell you what we do educationally to try to get that to happen. We try to get them to start ideas while they're in school, and if they're going to fail fast. And so experimentation is built into the entrepreneurial curriculum. And it's interesting, I'll give you an example. When we may start a cohort of 30 students in a given semester in a program that we've called the Foundry, and within 3 or 4 weeks, right, some of those ideas are going to be gone immediately. And so students will have failed, and we try to then walk them through why it failed and get them to learn and say, hey, look, you got another 4 weeks, try something new. So hopefully they will have seen it in a, you know, in a laboratory environment, right, so to speak, before they do it. I'm not sure, though, that still prepares you for when, you know, your life idea just falls out the window. It's hard. They've seen some of it before, but that is a painful experience.
It is. And, you know, I like the terminology that you're using, experiments, laboratory. And when I coach entrepreneurs and mentor them, one of the things I say is I think the big success stories that we see out there, Jeff Bezos is Amazon.com, Larry Ellison here locally, Josh James, David Elkington, Aaron Sconard, Rick Alden of Skull Candy, the list goes on and on. You mentioned it earlier, and I agree. There were a number of things that had to go their way. Maybe a little. It was a lot of hard work, but a little bit. There were times that if it weren't for a little bit of luck going their way, the path may not have worked. And I encourage entrepreneurs to think about it not as you're building this company, but you're asking interesting questions. We're trying to see the answer of, you know, will consumers buy something? Like, it's never been done before. Frame it as answering an interesting question, and then more likely than not, the answer is going to be no.
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, that's okay, because you've done everything you can to intelligently answer that question. And now you didn't fail, you didn't succeed. It's just you're asking yourself a series of interesting questions. And I like being around curious people. I like being around motivated people. And I find that resonates with people. The other piece is, so that's it. That's early on the mindset with the entrepreneur. The harder part is, how do we get our culture here in Utah to be more accepting of it? I think that's one of the things Silicon Valley still has an edge over us on. Is us as investors, us as friends, colleagues, fellow business people, framing it in a similar way. You know, the guy that had the courage to go out and start a company that maybe didn't succeed, let's celebrate it. You know, he did a great job. He gave it his best effort. And that person is now more valuable to our ecosystem than he was before. And somehow, I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah, no, it's a tough question. I think somehow we have to be able to distill from maybe the business failure, the growth and success that occurred in building the entrepreneur, right? Here's somebody that picked up, I don't know, expertise, a skill set, a sense for our opportunities, and maybe, to use your analogy and continue it, they asked a question and now they pivoted to a different question that's somewhat related, but that experience they had is not worth throwing out and is actually worth reinvesting.
And importantly, they persevered.
Yeah.
They went to a place they never thought they'd go in their lives. They dug deep. They did there's a right way to fail and there's a wrong way. And I think Utah entrepreneurs fail the right way, in part leading into my next question. But they dug deep and they found out something valuable about themselves and hopefully a very positive thing. You know, another hard thing to teach, but I think it's really important, is business ethics. I know it's an important subject at the business school. How do you teach entrepreneurs, how do you teach any business person ethics?
We have a huge ethics initiative going on right now. The Daniels Foundation out of Denver provides us a grant that's $250,000 a year to teach ethics. And we take a variety of approaches to that. Anything from case studies, which are built throughout our curriculum, to competitions, to guest speakers. And one of the big challenges is trying to see whether under pressure a student's kind of ethical foundation will hold. And frankly, education can only go so far. It's a big component of our education. It's every class we have probably has some component of ethics in it. I think all of our program directors and advisors talk about it frequently. And what you hope is that as people have learned business principles, they'll be able to recognize the situations where they're going to be tested. And hopefully they'll hold up under pressure.
I'm glad to hear you say that because it is the situations that get you in trouble, right? It's a slippery slope. And once you start going down it, it can go downhill very quickly. And some good advice in the Bible is to not fight temptation, but to run from temptation. And that's when I talk to entrepreneurs about it is, you know, there is a line, and the problem is you won't know you've crossed it until you've crossed it. So run from that. Just don't go there. Yes, you could justify maybe this one situation, but just don't go there.
Yeah.
Just have that line, have that internal compass. And with time, I think that gets stronger. And I also think because of the value system that we have here in Utah, I think our community has a stronger fiber there and a good base upon which to build. But you're right, ethics is hard to teach. I'm glad it's a focus. I didn't know about the program, the official programs that you have going on, but that's great. Let's take a quick break. Right now we're speaking with Taylor Randall. He's the dean at the University of Utah at the David Eccles School of Business. We've only got a few more minutes. I told you in the green room before the interview, I wanted to talk a little bit about your journey. We talked a little bit about it. You went in to get your MBA at the University of Warren University, decided to get your PhD. During that time, while you were getting your PhD, you worked with some inner-city youth in Philadelphia to give them experiences to help them kind of break out of the cycle that a lot of inner-city, lower-income kids find themselves in. How do we in the state of Utah, with the folks that might be inner city, don't have the opportunity, how do we help that group of folks get job ready and or college ready?
You know, that experience for me was a big turning point. Let me just kind of describe it a little bit. I was, you know, here I was with a set of PhD students at the Wharton School of Business. These are some bright folks.
And Wharton is in the inner
city. And so what we did is we took these PhD students that came from all over the world, China, Norway, India, you know, South America, and we said, you know, I want you guys to help me tutor. these kids, right? Let's go back and teach them basic mathematics and reading. And it was an interesting collision of this hyper-intellectual world and a group of kids that, you know, maybe didn't have parents in the home weren't staying in school. And I think what we realized is that it just takes a set of individuals that care deeply and are willing to get in and work with kids one-on-one. And then we've just got to provide access. We've got to provide access to, you know, obviously I'm a little bit self-interested here, but I think provide them access to universities and to education. And then that access has to be available on a set of dimensions, right? Not only does it have to be accessible financially, but some of these kids just don't even know exactly who they should talk to register at a university. We did a survey a few years ago trying to understand why some of the folks that had committed to come to the university didn't come to the university. And one of the main reasons was I just didn't have support around me to get me registered. And you know what? Once you give them the support, all of a sudden they're there. They begin to survive or to thrive. And things change, right? And society as a whole changes. And those are the folks that then say, you know what? I have an obligation to give back. And it's fun to see when somebody gets that light and kind of figures it out and helps.
And it's often these things that we take for granted that is really what these younger people need is just – you know, support for filling out, for getting all the requirements taken care of once they've been accepted. And then there's also just knowing when you're in high school, the classes you need to take to be college ready. And sometimes it's too late. They're a senior and they didn't take the right classes. And now community college is probably a path that would get folks.
Our community college does a great job.
That's what I was going to ask. How do you see your partnership with the community colleges in this state?
You know, I think we'd compliment the community college and what they do. They often fill that bridge and that gap. And I know for us, it's an important source of students. And we find that kids coming from community college often do extraordinarily well. I was back on Wall Street several weeks ago. Actually this was a group that I met 2 years ago, but I was back a couple weeks ago, but two years ago I met with a young man. I said, tell me your story. You graduated from the U, you're now a Wall Street investment banker. And he described how he came through Salt Lake Community College, and is now on Wall Street and right.
And there's lots of those stories.
There are lots of those stories. It's not just one. It's a lot.
I would guess like a third actually of people that succeed in college at the University of Utah. Maybe not that you would have the stats I want.
Yeah.
But I'm always surprised how many folks that said, you know, when I graduated high school, for whatever reason either, it wasn't the right time for them just personally. They weren't ready to put in the effort. They had an outside interest, or maybe they didn't take the right courses. But there are a lot of people that I've run into, not just here in the state of Utah, but in California as well, that said, you know, the community college is what got me on the right path. And then maybe they did a year there or 2 years, and then they transferred over. And it's also a lot more affordable to do that. So I agree with you. I think the community colleges here are a great thing. I don't want to get political. I won't ask your opinion, but I'll share with the audience. You know, President Obama said he wants to make community colleges free to folks. And I think that's a great idea, and I personally applaud that. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Taylor Randall, Dean at the University of Utah David Eccles School of Business. Last couple of questions. I'm going to lead off with the business school and then close with a couple personal questions. What's next for the University of Utah Business School? What's the next big, bold plan? I think I know the answer. We talked about the LaSan Studios. I'm sure that plays a role, but the big vision.
So what I see is big growth in the future for the business school. And let me tell you why. I think education is showing itself to be a global market. And institutions that can take a niche, which we're hoping, right, is entrepreneurship and innovation, can take that and leverage it and expand it and become not only a regional player, but a global player in that market. I think they are going to survive in the long term. And I firmly believe, right, that what we'll be able to add to the state and the entrepreneurial ecosystem will be will be enormous. And so I think you'll see kind of continued growth and continued reach outside the state to kind of bring in some of the best talent, whether that be business talent or engineering talent, computer science talent, whatever that is.
It's been amazing to see the transformation there over the last 6 years, and I think the future's even brighter. So very cool. I'm excited with that vision. You know, we've talked about a lot of these big, bold, difficult things that you've been able to lead and have support of donors and the broader community. Tell us about maybe a challenge in your life, your professional career, maybe where some didn't go the way that you were hoping that it would.
Well, you know, I think you mentioned this before. Sometimes you take leaps of faith and you just don't know where you're going to end up. I started my career at Arthur Andersen. I thought I was going to be a partner in an accounting firm, and I don't think I've done accounting now for 15 years.
It's funny how life works out.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And certainly, you know, I thought that was where it would take me. I think where I would like to see our school go is that while we're growing, and I think this is the challenge, is while we're growing, we still make education a personal experience, and that you're not a number. But you come in and you'll be able to identify with a professor or a staff member or a program director, and you'll know that, you know, the David Eccles School of Business cared about you and was a key part of your success. And I think that's kind of the big challenge we've got going into the future.
Great. And last question, I think our audience is going to be fascinated to hear. I certainly was when I heard it the first time. Your grandfather was also the dean of the business school at the University of Utah. And I want to give you a chance to tell us about your grandfather's legacy. Tell us about your grandfather.
Sure. You know, we are a family stuck in a serious rut, although I guess we like
it. It's a good rut.
We like it. So I'm the third generation business professor at the University of Utah. My grandfather moved from Ogden, Utah, got his education at the University of Utah, went to Stanford University for an MBA and a PhD, and became the dean. His dream was to move the business school out of the annex, which still exists at the University of Utah, and build a business complex. And it turned out my first day, my job was to tear those buildings down.
There's some irony there.
And unfortunately, I did not know my grandfather particularly well. He died when I was quite young. But, you know, I just hope I haven't destroyed too much of his dream. I hope I'm actually continuing his legacy. I'll tell you what I know about him. Is he believed that the business school at the University of Utah could be one of the great business schools in the country. And in that sense, I do connect with him, because I'm confident that this state and the people that are involved in that school will make the place great.
Well, your grandfather would be proud of you. I'm proud of all the things that you've done and your team at the University of Utah. We mentioned earlier, it takes a village, and you're an important part of that village, and the village here in Utah is better off for your involvement and your commitment. Congratulations on the success of your first 6 years at the University of Utah. We wish you all the best over the next 6 years, and hopefully longer than that. Thank you for your leadership on these projects and your leadership at the University of Utah, and thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks, Doug.
Our guest this morning has been Taylor Randall, who is the dean at the University of Utah David Eccles School of Business. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear my entire interview with Taylor on our website, kcpw.org. You can also tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.